Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Fred Shaw. Fred Shaw is a graduate of the University of Pittsburgh and Carlo University, where he received his MFA. He teaches writing and literature at Point Park University and Carlo University in Pittsburgh. He's the author of the chapbook Argot, available from Finishing Line Press. His poems have been published in 5 AM, Poet Lore, Permafrost, Slab, Spry Literary Magazine, Floodwall, Nerve Cowboy, Mason's Road, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, and Pittsburgh City Paper, where he currently reviews books. In a parallel life, he has also worked in the service industry for the past 25 years. He lives in Pittsburgh with his wife and rescued hound dog. Hi, Fred. How are you?
I'm doing excellent, Jan. Great to be here.
Yeah, really happy for you. I'm so excited about your new chapbook. Congratulations.
Thanks so much.
Okay, so you're going to read poems from that chapbook, is that right?
Yes, I thought I'd start off with some restaurant-related poems. Having worked in the business so long that it's definitely informed some of my work.
Okay.
So this first poem is called Jose at the Yum Yum Cafe, about an illegal immigrant working as a chef at a restaurant that was once in Oakland. Jose at the Yum Yum Cafe. Jose stir fries a blistering wok of lo mein, an illegal cooking the Szechuan dish for sweatshirted undergrads who slurp their noodles through chopsticks while he works over blue-flamed burners in a steamy kitchen. The steady heat of gas stoves like a rippled current of manual days and long labor. Over a joint at my girl's apartment, he will share his broken English journey. From a Costa Rican village to border crossing, for $1,000 he was smuggled in the back of aluminum U-Hauls. Jose spent the brutal Houston summers landscaping beneath a heavy-handed sun, scrubbed dishes in 100 Chicago eateries, then came to Pittsburgh's gray shore of opportunity. Maybe his America is now a cold-blooded embrace or a soggy foot. Maybe it's a wink, a paycheck under the table, tenement rent deducted from a non-negotiable wage, one nation united in its willingness to give him a bite, if only it can take its own bite back. Before I moved to New Orleans, Jose asked my help learning English. He wants to enroll in college. My time's short. I give him a book of poems, Bukowski lifted from a bookstore in my baggy pants, thinking that it will be a helpful and amusing way to learn the syntax of broken promises and understand a language of despair. But he already understands, so perhaps the pages will collect dust and needless folds among diasporas of Latin American dreams, that he will prefer to salsa dance on his rare time off, maybe at the Cozumel on Tuesday nights, with its specials on Cuervo and Corona and breathless partners spun into tops. This next poem is the title poem to my chapbook, Argot. It's in some way dedicated to my mother that sort of introduced me to the industry. Argot, in the sweaty restaurant kitchen where I'll learn to cuss in Mexican, tattooed line cooks talk trash in voices nicked as the bone-white monkey bowls we stack and fill. They call the boss and picky customers chupacabra, goat sucker being the inside joke for every pain in the ass. Years ago, in a place once a mustard factory, I was a boy touring mom's latest food prep gig, a windowless world where the clam chowder paddled around in vats deep enough for me to stand, and I wore a paper hat, same as the mustached men in bloody aprons who cut up and kitted while they hacksawed T-bones from beef sides. Now I dig 12-hour grooves of full trays and spaghetti joints with family names. I keep ice bins full and counters clean, wondering at times if the routine has replaced the oxygen of my dreams with a working life that takes what it wants, stealing my pen and handing me bad math on credit slips. On her days off, Mom wants to play Scrabble, but instead we talk about our fingers, how they've split into open-flowered nerves, stinging our bodies to the bulk of a weary self at the end of the day, each of us searching for the phrase that captures what it is to feel at once both capable and small. Waiting for Rain is a poem that comes from a restaurant that I worked at for 7.5 years, where our clientele was mostly elderly, excellent people, but definitely a lot of interesting things happened there. Waiting for Rain. Ice pails air dry on a stainless ledge, while we servers, hungry and hungover, hustle for an always early lunch crowd of middle-aged kids escorting creased-cheeked women, wheeling their walkers white-knuckled. Small feet in canvas keds shuffle over leaf-print carpet like delicate wind-up toys, cogs and gears turning. We move like bees, table to table, keeping the coffee filled, clearing the dirty china. Wary of their delicate bones, we try to tread lightly in heavy black shoes. To know this life as a parade of Sundays is to begin an education in a culture of demand, topping off the half-empty glasses of the dry-mouthed as if the water pitcher we lug about the dining room is a full cloud and the thirsty must wait like dry plants waiting for rain, their roots buried in sand. This next poem, Scraping Away, I was challenged to write a poem about a scallop that I had eaten off the floor of my first restaurant job, so this is what came of it. Scraping away. Once, when we were new, a plate of seafood crashed to the kitchen tiles and became the first scallops some of us had ever tried. Scraping away the broken to save the unscathed, we chewed briny mouthfuls of gritty, sweet meat, swimming in a sniff of garlic and white wine, thinking nothing ever tasted so good. As that moment passed into sounds of clinking, silverware, and carrying on, while Perry Como sang overhead, imploring us to learn the mambo's to and fro, a lesson we'll soon take to humming in a heaping world that needs us to believe we can be oceans pushing waves toward a shoreline we can't see, the worn down, far off places of ourselves.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Fred Shaw. He's reading from his new chapbook, Argot. Fred, can you talk about the title? Because I didn't know what it meant, and I wonder if some other people maybe don't.
Argot was a word that I came across in a short story. It may have been Melville. I don't recall. But for whatever reason, the word just struck me with its sort of a harsh sound at the end that I needed to look it up. And what I found out was that it means a specialized language, much the way that jazz musicians will speak to each other or restaurant employees as well, and sort of the language that they use on the job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love that you're writing restaurant poems. I mean, I think we need more of those, and that class just oozes from these poems. I think you do a great job of giving us these details, and I know that there are some poems that you couldn't read on the radio because of the FCC requirements. And you know, speaking of Argot and the specialized language, I know there's a lot of language in restaurants that can't be repeated here, which is too bad. So can you talk about writing these restaurant poems and the challenges of doing that?
Absolutely. One part of it was cutting it down. There just seemed to be so much to say about the landscape that is the service industry world, and the fact that most customers, guests as we're supposed to call them, often only see what we want them to see and don't see what happens in the kitchen What happens in the dish room where the dishwashers are working, behind the bar, in the office where the managers are? Often there's salty language going on. Oftentimes in the kitchen, there's a whole language that goes behind the utensils and the plateware, how we call for certain items, that I think really informed a lot of these things. But at the same time, I needed to pare it down to add some sense of compression, that it wasn't just a long list of things. And that was something that the Argot poem I really struggled with, that it was becoming just a list of all these sort of different specialized terms that I had to eventually pare back to the poem that I ended up with.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I love that poem. And I would really be interested in a listing poem with all that language in it. I really would.
Something to think about for sure. Love the list poem. I'm due for one.
You said someone challenged you to write about the scallop. I mean, that sounds like an interesting story. I don't know if you can tell it, but
I can. It was actually at my MFA defense, and one of my former professors that was on my defense committee. There was some discussion in other of my work about food in general, and I had sort of offhandedly mentioned that the first time I had ever eaten a sea scallop, it had fallen on the floor, and that professor challenged me. And that poem actually took at least 3 or 4 years and probably 100 revisions until I realized that what I had been writing was actually two poems that just needed to be chopped in half.
Yeah, great. Okay, can you read some more?
Absolutely. These next couple of poems are in honor of my father, who's also Fred Shaw, that passed away about 10 years ago, that I just think that there's... that he was, both of my parents made the idea of reading and literature very important to me. And, you know, we sort of had the typical father-son relationship, perhaps, that, you know, in hindsight, it would have been great that we were a little bit closer, but certainly meant quite a lot to me. So a few of these poems I wrote sort of in honor of him, but also just thinking about what it was that he meant to me. The first is 13 Steps. For his last 6 years, my father geared each night for the climb upstairs by gulping swallows of air into his shallow lungs. The tether of oxygen was necessary armor against all 13 steps, against disappointment that stretched to the edge of his queen size, now more goal line than restful. Here he sat with the clock radio tuned to KDKA, and waited to see if he would ever get comfortable again. Each humid July, I hauled the air conditioner up from the basement to his window frame. Under its awkward weight, I struggled not to gouge plaster divots from the walls, its sharp-pointed metal soon to be a humming box of Emerson Quiet Cool. My long feet plodded over older-than-me burnt orange carpet, laid over joist and squeaky floorboards. The stairwell was once my narrow playground, a lumpy slide, a fort. In recurrent dreams, I leaped from the top, weightless, never reaching bottom. This next poem, Proper Maintenance, is about my inheritance, which is a 1995 S10 pickup that constantly needs repaired. Proper maintenance. The red pickup is a listing heap with one tire like a bitten donut. Each crank of jack on pebbly driveway brings blood to my flayed knuckles. Heavy lug nuts make my shirt pocket sag. As wheel slides from axle, I battle gravity to a brief draw before dropping the metal rim on the grass. I am sweating in sun of early April, bold strokes of black grease smearing my flannel and jeans. The decade-old truck contains a litany of repairs. Its underside rattles on left turns. Tailpipe hacks at acceleration. Its glove box fills with papers, itemized bills detailing
cost of procedures, and GM parts. This is my inheritance, overseeing memories of my dad. We had beers at the Eagles Club, and later he drove me home. It was springtime, windows rolled down, the one time we rode in it together. This next poem has something to do with ginkgo trees, which there's really beautiful ginkgo trees in Frank Curto Park, which is along Bigelow Boulevard, which I would often take on my way to Carlo. And oftentimes after some of the lessons that we were working on in class had to deal with mementos and heirlooms that I would have my students writing about, and it made me think about these things myself. A ginkgo tree teaches me something about memory. Rooted to its sooty spit of land, stony and still, the ginkgo stands beside a boulevard of whispering full-speed cars, a living fossil shotgunning breath through the wet-lipped world. In class, I teach freshman writers the inanimate object is a trigger to pull on the past, to embrace detail while they capture the dead as a wedding band, a t-shirt, or the smell of an ant whose cheap perfume burned the throat, their fingers trying to touch all the ringed years under wrap, one long, dusty summer note. Now, watching a season change clothes amid the falling rain, I see how the ginkgo tree drops its yellow leaves all at once, unlike our human loss in sudden autumn. This next poem goes out to a good friend of mine named Demetrius that I used to live with going back some 20 years. It's called Demetrius's Glasses. All the girls on acid sitting cross-legged on the carpet of his unfurnished bedroom would try them on. Thick lenses with brown plastic frames. His glasses could amplify the best hallucinations. Demetrius moved from the Y to sleep in a house of misfits and stoners. Sometimes he would vanish. We all feared daylight back then, not looking much beyond months emptied of their useless laughter. In those days, we looked shady, dressed in yellow, pasta power t-shirts, busboys at Spaghetti Warehouse, smoking joints in alleys between double shifts. The passing dog walkers never said a word. We haven't hung out for years. It's hard to know what to say now that he's blind. I remember slipping on those glasses, their magnified blur, remember feeling helpless, the way he must feel in the dark and without them now.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Fred Shaw. He's reading poems from his new chapbook entitled Argot. Wow, those are really, really wonderful poems. One thing I'm noticing is the great sense of empathy and identification that comes through when you're describing people, and also a really authentic voice, a sense of the authentic that comes through. And I don't know if some of that is from choice of detail, what you're noticing, what you choose to include in the poems. But can you talk about how important that is to you to bring a sense of humanity to your work?
Absolutely. Whenever I first really started getting interested in poetry, it was the sense of narrative that I was getting from some of the poets that I was reading. Not an academic favorite, but Charles Bukowski was certainly an early influence on my work. The early University of Pittsburgh anthology, some of the work of Ted Kooser, Larry Levis in there. And the narrative sense in those poems really brought a sense of people out in them. And it was something that I both admired and wanted to try to replicate in my own way, that I just felt that the sense of people being involved in the poems, outside people, rather than always looking inward, looking outward and seeing them as being perhaps some reflection of who I am, having known these people and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think you do a good job of talking about some sad or challenging situations without getting sentimental or without objectifying. You know, I really like the poem about the father and the nine steps. I mean, it's a lot of heartbreaking stuff in there, and yet it never gets sentimental. So
yeah, the poem 13 Steps.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay.
I don't know where I got nine.
The poem 13 Steps was something that was actually that found its way into the Post Gazette, and I really got a lot of feedback on that from people saying that they sort of had their own memories as well as their own memories, not only of having to deal with a sick loved one, but also the idea of being a child again, and thinking about those places that we go to in our memory and how it is that we remember both people and places, and that how they make us the people and writers that we often become.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you have some other kinds of poems, some tough poems in there. You have a poem called Bully, is that right? Or
indeed.
Why don't you read that?
Yes. It's my sister absolutely hates this poem. But it came from an essay by Tony Hoagland on negative capability, and I just thought that it was interesting that I do try to come across that my sensibilities, the voice that I use often does have a sense of empathy that maybe I'm not perhaps quite aware of, but I certainly don't ever want to be thought of as a bad person, and I thought I would just go in a little bit of a different direction with this as a bit of a mea culpa in some sort of way. Bully. Although it was my sister who took the training wheels off my Schwinn, and sex ed came from a spongy copy of Penthouse stashed in the woods, it was Dad who first taught me to ball a fist, to keep the thumb outside and aim for the nose. He wasn't thinking of the punches I'd later land on Daryl's round head and Kool-Aid-stained mouth. Year after year, I'd dish out the same pounding each time he visited his aunt, our one-sided backyard brawls becoming less about his weak wiffle ball play than my need for our game to end in his cries. This is before I began to stare at the handicapped or whipped mom with a wire hanger, before I stoned stray cats and mistook cruelty for honesty when I asked my first girlfriend if the rumors of her being a whore were true. To say that I once prayed on the weak as if it were a rite of passage would be to wonder if Daryl still remembers how I taught him to spit blood and swear at the top of his lungs, learning at my hands how to give with all he had. I'm going to move into a couple of kind of musical poems. First one, Punk, is about my unsuccessful attempt to go to the Electric Banana, the famous punk club in North Oakland, whenever I was a teenager and was pretty scrawny. Punk. I keep embarrassment in a stash, stacked and piled like yellowed news, in cracked plaster rooms, off behind the kitchen table of my mind, a place to visit my drunken faux pas, file away the file-ups, and feel bad about the time I hit an old woman in the mouth with a jar full of maraschino cherries. Sometimes I thumb through to that time when Leo and I were 16 and we sat parked for hours in front of the Electric Banana. A punk club will never go inside out of fear our night might end in a busted nose from a swirling mosh pit full of knees. Our missed chance to stomp and bleed on a sticky dance floor still jangles like loose change in a pocketful of sad attempts to fit in. But it's only after Leo's blonde hair is lost to glue and malt liquor and a botched attempt at dreadlocks, after he buzzed it close to the skull and we lose touch, that I'll come to know so well those minor threat cassettes that click in a dusty Delco tape deck while we watch the Iron City punks loiter about the Bananas' front door in their comfortable mohawks and effortless combat boots. Marooned and sober behind a foggy windshield, a lush hillside fails to take shape. And I find that, years later, I am a self full of deeds undone, going places where so much is an idling Chevy with a paint job the color of contusion. This next poem is about one of the last Grateful Dead shows. Was never a huge Deadhead. I thought some of them were a bit of phonies in some sort of way, but I always loved the vibe of the shows. Section 620, June 30th, 1995. From the upper decks of Three Rivers, poured onto Pittsburgh's north side as a multi-use stadium circa 1970, a place with all the character of a concrete ashtray, imploded since we swayed that night away, thousands deep in the psychedelic darkness, moving among steep aisles and the plastic yellow seats, lit and spun on LSD and K while the Dead played, unknown to us all, one of their final shows, before Jerry Garcia could no longer rise to play another encore, and I forgot I was afraid of heights. Rain played metaphor as the second set began, the muggy air wet with synchronicity and improvisation. We stayed dry under overhanging roof and chewed on ice cubes, knowing convergence is something to behold, the sizzle of good vibe coming together amid astroturf and summer storm. Here, there was no Ginsberg or Kesey, and I would never whirl like a dervish, trying hard to hold my head on straight, wishing earlier that blue June day among the asphalt parking lots, among the beer bottles, for the hunger of a constant moon, one that could hover and hold still time before places and days like these are all gone. This next poem is Bebop Alarm Clock, about one of the first times I listened to jazz, one of my loves of my life. Bebop Alarm Clock. Inside a small rectangle of black plastic and red-eyed numbers was a tuning bar sometimes too broad to find the decimals of narrow bandwidth. A jazz station tucked between static on the clock radio tuner's two-way street. A single speaker stuck beneath a ridged grill could pucker a brain with blood, collect from thin air all the desire and sadness in the world, make heart, lungs syncopate and praise madmen musicians who wrung out of this wrong century something alive and escaped.
It's the poetry of Fred Shaw. Thank you so much, Fred. That was great.
Thank you, Jan.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody 90.5 WESA.